court will proceed to the second case of the day, the National Coalition of Prayer versus et al. Versus Carter. Mr. Kobolevitz.
May it please the court. The appeal for public support on behalf of a nonprofit organization is a form of fully protected speech. There is none, nor can there be, any legal precedent for the proposition that charities using compensated agents are entitled to less protection under the First Amendment than charities which use in-house employees to make their appeals. Schomburg, Munson, and Riley, the trio of the United States Supreme Court decisions in the 1980s, firmly and unconditionally established the precedent that the full plenary protection of the First Amendment was not lost when the charity speaks through a compensated representative. The decision of the lower court would reverse this precedent. To reach its result, the district court ruled incorrectly that the act in the case at bar was not a form of content-based regulation. We know from the Playboy case and many others cited in our briefs that if you must know the content and status of the speaker, of the speech, it is content-based regulation. In order for the Attorney General to enforce the act in the case at bar, they must know the source of the call, the purpose of the call, what was said during the call, and the status of the caller. The conclusion that the law is premised on content of speech and or the status of the speaker. The law is clear on this subject. Any statute regulating any form of fully protected speech based upon its content or the status of the speaker must be evaluated as content-based regulation. If one must necessarily look at the content of speech to determine whether law applies, then the law is content-based. This, of course, is the Arkansas Writers Project versus Raglan. Content-based restrictions on speech are presumptively invalid and subject to strict scrutiny. The distinction of whether the call is allowed or prohibited is based upon whether the individual is compensated is directly contrary to the Supreme Court holding in Meyer versus Grant.
Well, the act here doesn't forbid charities from making phone calls soliciting donations as long as they use their own employees or volunteers. And doesn't that suggest that the act only regulates the form of the phone call and not the content?
No, because it's based upon the status of the caller. And Meyer versus Grant is the case out of Colorado that had to do with the prohibition against using compensated leafleteers in the court held that that was a form of content-based regulation. On page 781 of the Riley decision, the court said, and I quote, "It's well settled that a speaker's rights are not lost merely because compensation is received. The speaker is not less a speaker because he or she is paid to speak," end of quote. The state justifies the act's restrictions on telephone calls on the grounds that the sheer volume of the category of calls are unreasonable, objectionable, and intrudes on residential privacy. This conclusion is not based upon any findings or empirical data. It is anecdotal, and according to the Playboy case, also a U.S. Supreme Court decision, restrictions on speech cannot be based on an anecdotal. In her decision, Judge Barker acknowledged how close in her mind the decision was when she stated on page 17 of her decision, quote, "Only by examining the specific content of the telephone solicitor's speech could authorities determine whether the ordinance was violated. This approach seems strongly to suggest content-based regulation." There can be little doubt that the state's interest in regulation is based upon content or status of the callers. Again, in Judge Barker's decision...
Well, status and content are two different things. I just don't know how that this goes to the content of the speech. If you want to prohibit professional telemarketers from calling, it's harassing. People don't like to get these calls at 6 o'clock at night. And the apparently from the legislation that the primary abusers of this are paid telemarketers. So
There is no data to support that. That's a conclusionary assertion that's anecdotal. What Judge Barker said is that people want to escape from sales calls. These are not sales calls. Sales calls are subject to commercial speech regulation. These are free speech activities. The Supreme Court has held, indeed, in the footnote in the Schomburg case, says that carefully trained professional representatives of charitable organizations offer less of a threat to the public than do employees or volunteers. This is based upon the content, because these same people can call, the same telephone can ring, the same message can be delivered, and the only difference is one call is allowed because it's an employee if they comply with the other requirements, but the other call is not allowed because they're being compensated by an outside company.
You don't see any rational basis for differentiating between paid telemarketers and actual employees or volunteers of an organization?
There is no rational basis. There's no rational basis in this record. And as we have quoted in here, the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission also found there were no reason to subject the calls made on behalf of nonprofits to an outright ban. Under the federal rules as cited, it's a opt-out. If a person calls you and you can tell them not to call you again, that's the subject. Here, Indiana went further. There's not even a provision in this law for the charities in Indiana to call their past supporters if they use a compensated representative. That was the issue in the Riley case, and the court held that you can't make that kind of distinction. This whole argument about volume of calls being a content-neutral justification has no merit to it, because you can take out any segment of calls and say it doesn't have that many calls, so we're going to say this group is okay. It allows judgment the unfettered discretion to pick and choose between speakers when both are engaged in fully protected speech.
Wasn't there evidence presented in the record that reflects that a single four-hour telemarketing shift has the ability to dial 16,000 phone numbers in 1 month? Wasn't that some of the evidence that the district court looked at and was presented to the court?
That pertained, again, to sales calls. The reference was always to sales calls. There is no reference.
Yeah, but the fact is telemarketers, they're paid. They know how to manipulate. They know how to make these calls. I mean, I think the court looked at the fact that there was this potential that number of calls could
There's
be made.
The same,
isn't that what the court should have focused on?
There's the same potential for employees to have the same technology and the same capability. There is no distinguishable difference. The only difference is who signs the paycheck. The technology that allows thousands of calls to be made can be owned by anyone. It's who is being compensated, and you can't make that distinction. You can't carve out exceptions. This is a Pearson versus Edgar case. They have taken one group of speakers and said that they're reviled speech.
Yeah, the speech comes through here, does it not, Scoble? I mean, you're not altering speech here. The same speech would come from the volunteer versus the telemarketer. So we don't have, unless you're talking about the volume of the speech, I mean, total number of people reached, we're not shutting down the message, are we?
You're certainly shutting down the message.
Well, you're shutting down, you mean the number of people the message can reach, or are you shutting down the message? Well, how do you shut down the message if the same message is given by the telemarketer as by the volunteer?
Because the smaller charities, the plaintiffs in this case, as in the Riley case in 1988, are charities that do not have the resources to bring their telemarketing in-house.
Their voice can't be heard as far. Is that what you're saying? As far the message can get out, it just can't reach
discriminatory application of a free speech restriction that the Supreme Court has rejected on every single occasion that has come before it. This is the Riley case all over again. In the Riley case, there were restrictions put on charities that used compensated representatives that weren't on employees or volunteers for the charity. The Supreme Court affirmed Schomburg, Munson, and Riley on page 791 of the Riley decision. Indeed, the Attorney General has admitted that this is preferential judgment by the state by noting the regulation was based upon speech that was most commonly reviled by the citizens of the state of Indiana in their motion for summary judgment on page 41. In the case at bar, the restrictions on calling residents of Indiana are subject to a series of exemptions, no doubt propounded by those with the most effective lobbyists. There is no reason to believe the exempt calls have any different effect on the residential privacy than those which have been silenced.
So in your view, this statute is unconstitutional as it's written, but it would be constitutional if more speech was prohibited.
If this law applied to everyone on an equal basis, then it would be content neutral, just like Hill versus Colorado with the pamphleting, just like the case with the sound system. It didn't depend upon the status of the speaker or the content of the speech. Here you can't know whether the speech is prohibited in the case of a compensated caller calling you on behalf of a nonprofit until you know the full content of the conversation. I can call you on behalf of Special Olympics and ask you to attend the game to support the athletes. That call is permissible. That call can disturb your privacy at home. But if I add, and we need your support, I'm now in violation of the Indiana law. I can be subject to a $10,000 penalty. I'm engaged in fully protected speech. I have the right to deliver my message, regardless of the medium. If we've learned one thing from Schomburg, Munson, and Riley, it's the message that we're protecting here. It's the medium is inconsequential. You must look to the core of the delivery of the message. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Kovalev. Mr. Fisher?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. With respect to the definition of content neutrality, as the district court itself acknowledged, this does not have to do with whether content determines application. It has to do with whether content determines justification. And Judge Barker, after acknowledging that there were some content questions in terms of application, went on to say, however, the determination of content neutrality rests not so much on the specific content of the communication as on the legislative justification for the restrictions. And, in fact, this is exactly one of the grounds that the Eighth Circuit reversed a district court in North Dakota. That district court had taken the view that content neutrality was a function of whether you look at content for application purposes, and the Eighth Circuit said no. In fact, a law exactly like this that regulates charities by permitting in-house calls but to people who have registered for telephone privacy but prohibiting those by paid contract telemarketers is a content-neutral law because it is justified by reference not to the content of paid telemarketers' calls but by the volume of the calls. In fact, we actually do have evidence in the record concerning the relationship between paid professional telemarketers and the need for greater protections of privacy. A philanthropic fundraising expert named Tim Seiler provided an affidavit, and this is again on the supplemental appendix, page 46, paragraph 15, where he says, because paid professional telemarketers typically earn a percentage of each donation, they have a direct financial incentive to make as many calls as possible. Charities, volunteers, and employees typically do not have similar incentives to maximize the number of calls they make. So there we have an expert in the field acknowledging what common sense would already tell us, which is that paid professional telemarketers, those who work on a contract basis, are likely to dial many more numbers than in-house employees and volunteers. Furthermore, in the mainstream marketing case out of the Tenth Circuit, which upheld the federal no-call regulations that applied to commercial speakers, the court analyzed that certainly under the central Hudson test, but that's a test that really doesn't have much in the way of material distinction from the content-neutral time, place, and manner test. And it said that you can rely on things like common sense to justify distinctions of the sort that we have here between in-house callers and paid professional telemarketers.
Well, does that exception for charitable solicitations unfairly burden small charities, you know, who have small staffs or small volunteer base?
Well, empirically, we don't know. We have, I think, some affidavits in the record here from these plaintiffs saying that because they are small, they will not be able to afford in-house calling campaigns. But we don't have any statistical sort of, you know, broad survey type of evidence with respect to that. But regardless, the point is, can that distinction, notwithstanding those kinds of effects, if they were to occur, be justified without reference to content, and even without reference to the size of the charity? And plainly they can. It has to do with the volume and the amount of privacy individual citizens would stand to lose if they were allowed to be called by paid professional telemarketers.
Mr. Fisher, could Indiana, in the interest of protecting the kind of privacy that is apparent in the legislative intent, at least to me, suggest that in political campaigns that only volunteers for a candidate could go door-to-door and put stuffings in mailboxes, but that paid volunteers could not. Do you think that would pass constitutional muster? And
well,
is there an analogy to what we have here?
In other words, treat political campaigns the same way as these charities.
Yes.
Yes, I think that would survive equally. I mean, I think that the General Assembly is not required to do that. But so long as that distinction, again, is justified not by reference to content, but reference to residential privacy and what's being protected, the non-speech interest, the privacy interest, I don't see any difference in those two. The other distinction that has come up is the difference between pure advocacy calls and calls that are made to solicit money. And again, the same expert that we had that talked about the difference between in-house and contract telemarketers also talked about the difference between the peer advocacy and the solicitation. And again, it comes down to what you would common sense would tell you, which is that a call that is going to try to raise money is more likely to pay for itself and is more likely to be self-perpetuating and is therefore more likely to lead to more invasions of privacy, whereas peer advocacy calls aren't necessarily going to be that way. And, in fact, that's the distinction that's drawn all the time across the country in these kinds of laws, that calls that are made to solicit money that are self-financing are in a different category precisely because of their impact on residential privacy. This case is not at all similar to Pearson v. Edgar, which is the case that had to do with limiting a similar type of opt-in program to real estate calls. That case was not predicated originally on the notion of protecting residential privacy. It was actually predicated on the notion of discouraging blockbusting of neighborhoods. And the evidence in the record in that case did not support the notion that blockbusting was a problem, so instead the government had to fall back on residential privacy as an alternative interest, and certainly one that was not, I think, in any genuine sense, part of the original motivation for the law. And the court said this is not the kind of restriction that's going to protect privacy because all you're doing is restricting real estate calls. Well, in this case, we have a law that restricts all commercial calls, with the exception of a few, and it draws a balance with respect to charities between paid professional telemarketers and in-house callers. And the evidence shows that this is a very effective law in terms of protecting residential privacy. A survey shortly after the law went into effect showed that unwanted telephone sales calls dropped by 80% for people who had registered for the protection of the law. In fact, over 98% of respondents said that they received less or much less in terms of unwanted telemarketing calls. So notwithstanding the way the law is structured, with any exceptions, it is a remarkably effective law. Furthermore, this type of law, I think, has to be analyzed in a way that is somewhat different from ordinary time, place, and manner laws that come before the court, in the sense that the opt-in provision puts this law into the category of merely enforcing individual preferences with respect to residential privacy. If we go back, for example, to the Rowan case of, I think, around 1970, the court said that a regulation requiring the Postmaster General not to forward materials that an individual thought to be provocative was permissible because it wasn't the government making the decision. It was the individual making the decision. And in fact, the court in that case achieved the result of upholding that rule based on a balancing test, simply balancing the individual householder's interest in not receiving that material versus the sender's interest in trying to breach the barrier of a household that didn't want to hear from them. We have a very similar interest in this case, and I think the similar kind of deference is owed to the government in terms of protecting residential privacy interests and preferences. So it's not even necessary, in our view, to reach the content neutrality inquiry because the Rowan balancing test really is the kind of test that ought to apply to a law such as this that effectuates individual privacy preferences. Even Hill v. Colorado, which does go through the content neutrality analysis, relies a bit on Rowan and gets into this idea that the law that is purely trying to protect individuals who don't want to receive the bombardment of either a solicitation or even advice in that case, that those kinds of laws are perfectly valid. With respect to the more general theme of the plaintiffs in this case, that the law doesn't restrict enough speech, or that there are exceptions that shouldn't be there, I would just like to point the court to the Fourth Circuit decision in a case recently, National Federation of the Blind, where the court upheld the FTC's rule requiring telefunders to maintain charity-specific in-house lists. And part of the argument in that case, again, was that it was under-inclusive, that there should be more categories of speech regulated. And the Fourth Circuit went through a very careful analysis where it talked about the dangers of under-inclusiveness analysis, where you essentially require the government to start to regulate more speech in order to get at the problem they really want to arrive at. And I think that is a very persuasive analysis of the kinds of interests that are at stake here. If there are no further questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Ms. Kovalevitz, I don't find in your briefs, and perhaps I just missed it, a discussion of Rowan. Do you feel that's just an inapplicable case to this
No, I think Rowan is very applicable, and I'd like to begin my rebuttal by taking up the last two items that opposing counsel talked about. Rowan is very different than this case. Rowan is an opt-in on an individual basis. In Rowan, and under the federal postal laws, an individual can tell the postmaster that they don't want to receive anything from a designated sender. That's much different here. Here, the government has decided, the legislature, impacted by lobbyists, has decided if you opt in, who can't contact you. That's Pearson versus Edgar. In Rowan, it's an individual decision. It's not the government's decision. That's consistent with what the federal communications did.
Perhaps I'm not tracking. What is the difference between registering on a do not call list? Why isn't that an individual decision? That's not a government decision.
It's an individual decision to go on the list, but it's the government who has determined who may call you and who may not. It is not you. If I supported a charity 25 straight times when they called me, and I want to get away from the lawn services and the credit cards, and I sign up, that charity, if they use a compensated individual, can't call me. In the Rowan case, if someone sends me mailing that I find objectionable, I notify the postmaster, who notifies that single sender. I don't cut off everybody based upon the government's judgment.
Even if the sender is a sender of multiple publications, I mean, so you don't know, you got one publication you didn't want, and then you say, I don't want anything from Acme Publications, but Acme Publications could have sent you 10, 20 different.
You can choose the sender, the individual sender, and you can send to Acme Publications saying, I find what you have sent me to be offensive. That doesn't mean that Beta Publications can't send you. Here, it does mean that. Look at the calls that are allowed under this legislation. Unwanted personal calls, survey calls, political solicitation for candidates, advocacy calls, newspapers, and that's classic. In the record is the Indiana Star editorial that says you don't mess with people who buy their ink by the barrel. That's the impact of the lobbyists here and government impact on this thing. Debt collectors, insurance agencies, charities using employees or volunteers, and political action committees, Section 527 groups raising money. All of these people can call you. There is no difference on the privacy issues of the individuals on those calls as compared to the calls made by small charitable organizations that must rely on outside professional help. The phone still rings. It's the same content. It's the same time. It's the same issue. But government is engaging in looking at people who are engaged in fully protected speech and saying, your speech isn't popular. We're going to limit your speech, and we're going to allow your speech because you buy ink by the barrel. It's just not proper. And the reliance on the Fourth Circuit court case, the Federal Trade Commission, NFB case, is also improper. First of all, under the Federal Trade Commission telephone sales rules, it's exactly like Rowan. If someone calls you and you don't want them to call you, you opt out and you say, don't call me again. Secondly, the basis of the decision in the FTC case was the lack of jurisdiction. They excused the uneven application of the law because the FTC did not have jurisdiction. In this case, that is not present. The expert in the field is based upon, I mean, this is a declaratory judgment action, so there's really no evidence in the record. The Main Street marketing we've talked about, could Indiana protect privacy in a political campaign using volunteers? That is exactly the issue here. They have picked and chosen. They didn't put the limitations on the politicians. They put it on the small charities. They put it on those who use professional fundraisers. They have favored those that they want to protect. It is an unconstitutional favoring of one speaker over another. This is Pearson versus Edgar. In Pearson, the homeowner could not ban any other bothersome solicitation, only that chosen by the state. Clearly the case here. The choice of the state is who shall be banned is like a wall that protects homeowners from unwanted calls, except this wall is filled with holes for those that they favor to come within. The use of reviled speakers and isolating it permeates this record. The motive of the state is suspect in all regards in creating this kind of legislation. The heavy hand of the Indiana legislature, propelled by powerful lobbyists that impacted this legislation, falls short of the standards of Broderick versus Oklahoma, which said it has long been recognized that First Amendment needs breathing space. Statutes attempting to restrict or burden the exercise of First Amendment rights must be narrowly drawn and represent a considered legislative judgment that a particular mode of expression has to give way to other compelling needs of society. There is no considered legislative judgment here. This is a popularity contest. A constitutional democracy protects the minority. The holdings in Metro Media and Discovery Network compel a finding by this court that the wide range of exemptions given to commercial interests create a direct injury to the plaintiffs in the case at bar and those similarly situated because their speech is being restricted while other nonprofits and commercial interests are not. The justification for the unequal treatment simply does not withstand scrutiny. Here the issue is free speech, but even in commercial speech case, and Pearson versus Edgar was a commercial speech case in which case the speech had less protection, and this court struck it down and said, we can no longer, after Discovery Network, place the interest of residential privacy above the interest in logical distinctions in speech restrictions, absent some showing the restriction reasonably fits the justification. Well, here you have strict scrutiny, not a reasonable fit. And in the Pearson versus Edgar case, this court found that there was not a fit. And how can there be a fit here when there are all of these exemptions? There are commercial speech favors. There are editorials and papers that say, we're more powerful lobbyists than you have, and so we can call you. The justification of this law is suspicious. It cannot withstand strict scrutiny. It cannot withstand First Amendment scrutiny. We ask the court on behalf of the charitable industry to strike this law to the extent it threatens the free speech rights of charities differently based upon the status of the speaker and or less favorably than commercial speech. Thank you.
So just as a matter of interest, do we have any statistics indicating how broad a category we have of these small charities that seek the need the telemarketing approach? As opposed to the mega charities that I guess the Red Cross or whatever?
Well, what this legislation will do, it will encourage charities to go into the telemarketing business. They will devote their resources to buying this expensive equipment, to running the risk of having a broad employee workforce. And some charities have done that in Indiana. Some more will do it. And there are some, like these plaintiffs, that simply don't have the resources to do it. There are no statistics to answer your question.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the third.